No pressure, right? So, good morning. We're in the fourth week of our series on the Gospel of John. And as we've been seeing over the past few weeks, the Gospel of John is somewhat different to the other Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It still tells us many of the things Jesus did and the things he said, but it does so in a very carefully constructed way to communicate some deliberate themes. And as we've been seeing, if you've been here the last few weeks, one of those themes, perhaps the most important theme, is who is Jesus? Who does Jesus claim to be? Who do people who met him say that he is? And who does the writer of the Gospel of John believe him to be? And if you were here for the first week in the series, we saw that the writer says that Jesus is God. Jesus is the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then over the last few weeks, we've touched a couple of times on this idea of Jesus as the light that comes in to the darkness and the chaos of a perishing world. We touched that a couple of times, and we're going to look at that, as Matthew said, in a lot more detail today. Jesus, the light of the world. The section that we're looking at today is chapters 7 through 10. Obviously, we are not going to look at anything like all of the material that's in those chapters. We're just going to touch on three passages that relate to this concept of Jesus as the light of the world. But I would encourage you, either on your own or in your discipleship groups, to read those chapters in full, because there's a lot of really great stuff in those chapters that we're just not going to be able to get to today. So these chapters are part of that section of the Gospel of John that we've referred to as the Book of Signs. As you may remember, the setting for this part of John is the celebration in Jerusalem of a series of Jewish festivals. And there's kind of a pattern to the stories in this section. What typically happens is Jesus does a sign or a miracle, and there's a long discussion about what does this mean, what does this tell us about who Jesus is, and then it kind of escalates, and we end up with some people believing in Jesus and others saying he's crazy or he's a sinner and we should get rid of him. And that we'll see that this passage today follows this pattern exactly. So if we could put up the beginning of chapter 7. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go back to Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. But when the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." So we've already got some of these themes, people trying to kill him, some people believe in him, some disciples, and we've got the festival. The festival is the Festival of Tabernacles. This was one of the three most important festivals for Jews. The other two were Passover, which we looked a little bit at last week, and Pentecost. And these three festivals were a really big deal. If you were a Jewish male, either a youth or an adult, and you lived within a 15-mile circumference of 15-mile radius, sorry, what happened to my math degree there, a 15-mile radius of Jerusalem, you were legally obliged to go up to the temple to celebrate these festivals. But people would come from much further afield. Historians estimate that the population of Jerusalem probably tripled during the festivals, from about 50,000 to about 150,000. And I'm sure this surge in the adult male population of Jerusalem helped to contribute to the nationalistic feelings that were often accompanied these festivals. Throughout history, there are incidents of riots and uprisings, often very violent, that happened on some of these festivals. And so there would typically be a lot more soldiers there and a lot more in evidence, or, you know, a lot more visible to keep the peace. So these were very great celebrations, but also there was this kind of tension in the air. Each of the three festivals celebrated three different things. Firstly, they celebrated the time of the year in the agricultural calendar. Secondly, they celebrated an event in Jewish history. And thirdly, they celebrated the theological truth that was demonstrated through that event. So the Festival of Tabernacles, firstly, was the grape and olive harvest. It was the last of the harvest. The grain one was a couple of months before that. This is a September-October time. And it was a great cause of joy. In fact, people were commanded to be joyful at this festival. The other two festivals are a little bit more solemn. But this was a great Thanksgiving. You know, it was the end of the agricultural season. All the harvest was gathered in. It was a time for thanking God for his provisions. The historical event was remembering that the Jews had wandered through the wilderness after they were brought out of slavery in Egypt, and God had provided for them. And so people would build temporary shelters out of branches, they'd put them on the roofs or in the courtyards, out in the street, and they would basically live in them for the week of the festival. They'd have the meals in there, they'd invite friends over, the men would sleep in there. It was like a giant camp out, you know, to try and act out what it must have been like to be wandering through the wilderness. So I think it was a lot of fun. It was a very joyful festival. And from the theological angle, they were celebrating not only God's provision through the harvest and through the time that they were wandering in the wilderness, but they were also remembering that, or looking forward to the day when people from all nations would come and worship the Lord. This is something that Zechariah prophesied about, and I think we have that verse, following the day of the Lord, in the day of the Lord, then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. So in some ways this was a really Jewish festival, but at the same time held this promise that this was going to be a celebration for all nations to come and worship the Lord. Now, there was a ceremony that was very central to the Feast of Tabernacles that I think it's worth taking some time to look at because it provides context for some of the things that Jesus said that we're going to be reading in just a moment. And that that ceremony was the drawing of water, or the water libation ceremony. And what happened was that on each day in this week-long festival, in the evening, people would gather in one of the temple courts, in the court of women, and there would be four giant golden bowls that were set on pillars. And the pillars were 75 feet high, six stories high. These were big. And young men would climb up ladders up the side of these pillars and fill them with oil and light them. And these oil lamps would burn all night. And it was said that the light from these lamps was sufficient to illuminate all the courtyards in Jerusalem. And people would dance with flaming torches among the pillars, and people would sing, and it would go on all night. And then at dawn, a priest would lead a procession out of the temple, down through the city, up just outside the city walls, and where there was a spring that filled the pool of Siloam, which we'll look at in a little bit. And he would fill a golden pitcher with water from the spring, and then take everybody back up with musicians and everything up back to the temple, in through the temple through a special gate called the water gate, and then would pour this water onto the altar as an offering. And everybody would cheer and then sing and wave branches and rejoice. And it was kind of the climax of the rejoicing on this, the most happy of the festivals. In fact, the sages of Israel who wrote back a little around about Jesus' time said, whoever has not seen the celebration of the festival of water libation has never experienced true joy in his life. So this was a really big deal. This was like the happiest of ceremonies. And then everybody would go home, and then the next night they would come and do the ceremony again. And this ceremony had lots of different layers of symbolism. The water at one level represented the rains, so thanking God for the rains that had caused the harvest and praying also for the rain for the following agricultural year. And thanking God for the water that he provided for Israel miraculously as they were wandering through the wilderness. But symbolically, it also represented salvation. In fact, as the priest came through the water gate, people would quote Isaiah 12:3, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And as the priest poured the water on the altar, everyone would sing from Psalm 118, O Lord, save us. So it really had this feeling of salvation, water represented salvation. And a little bit less obviously, it also represented the law. In Ezekiel 47, it talks about the law going out from the temple like water, flowing out from the temple and bringing life wherever it went. So there were lots of different meanings around the water. And similarly with the light, The light, to some extent, represented the glory of God. So the first temple that was built about 1,000 years before Jesus' time was dedicated. Jesus was at the second temple. That temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, and then they rebuilt the second temple. But at the first temple that Solomon built, it was dedicated during this festival of tabernacles. And we read in 1 Kings 8 that the temple was filled with a cloud of God's glory. So this light represented the glory of God. Other rabbis said that this light again represented salvation. And the people would quote Isaiah 9:2, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned." And then the combination of this water and the fire of these lamps also was said to represent the cloud of the pillar of cloud that guided the Israelites by day, and the pillar of fire that guided them by night when they were wandering through the wilderness. So there were lots of different layers of meaning. I think that's not surprising. We do the same with our own holiday traditions. We probably all had a Christmas tree. If you look at, well, why do we have a Christmas tree? There are so many different reasons that people say, well, we have it because it represents the tree from the Garden of Eden, and that was done in the medieval mystery plays, and they were done on Christmas Eve, and that's why you have apples on the tree. You know, and other people say, no, the shape was used to represent the Trinity. Other people, I lived in Georgia for a couple of years, they say it represents the beard of St. Basil the Great. You know, I mean, there are so many different meanings. Over time, different meanings get added to our holiday traditions, and that's kind of what happened here. So this was a moment that was rich with symbolism about life, about salvation, about the law and about the temple. There's a lot of nationalistic feeling. People were, you know, rejoicing, really happy, but at the same time there's this note of tension. And into this context, Jesus stands up and makes a statement. We read in John 7. "On the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stood up and said in a loud voice, 'If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him.'" And then a little bit later on in John 8, "When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, 'I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life.'" I think this must have been really shocking. I mean, we just read it, but here they were, more than 100,000 people, focusing on the temple and on the law as the source of life and salvation. And Jesus stands up and says, "You know all this? It's all about me. I am the light of the world. I bring the living water. I bring the life. I bring the salvation. Not the temple, not the law, but me." Must have been incredibly shocking. One commentator tried to sum up how he thought the people might feel. "How and why would God's power and perfection be contained in human form? It was not possible and it was not needed. God had given his people what they needed in the law and the temple. Who would forsake these gifts, palpably endorsed by God, to rely on Jesus, endorsed only, it seemed, by himself? He's a madman, or worse." And we'll see in a little bit, that's exactly how people respond. Some say he's crazy, and others say, you know, he's worse. He's a sinner, he's a blasphemer, and we should get rid of him. But what did Jesus' claims mean to ordinary people? Not the religious people, but just the ordinary, everyday people. I want to look at a couple of stories that are set around these statements that look where Jesus is interacting with individuals. The first story is quite a well-known story of the woman caught in the act of adultery. Now, this story is actually not found in the earliest manuscripts that we have of the Gospel of John. It is found in some 4th century Greek manuscripts. It's possibly referenced right at the end of the 1st century, beginning of the 2nd, by a bishop. That's not really certain. St. Augustine, in the beginning of the 5th century, he said that it was in the original, and New Testament editors, the early editors, took it out because it was too scandalous. We don't know if that's true, but that was what he claimed. But if you're interested in the history behind, you know, which manuscripts it's in, and some of the details of that, there's actually an interesting page on Wikipedia of all places, so you can go and look it up. But we do have that story. Personally, I think there's more reason for keeping it in than taking it out. But as we read it, you'll see that in its current form, it's not written by the same writer that wrote the rest of the Gospel of John. It doesn't read the same, it's not the same style or words that are used in this passage that are used nowhere else in the Gospel. In fact, it reads more like a synoptic story, one from one of the synoptic Gospels, Jesus giving pithy answers. And some manuscripts do put the story in the Gospel of Luke. But let's read it. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who had heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." I think this is a very ugly scene, isn't it? They drag this woman and they make her stand before the group. I mean, these are people who were, you know, you get the sense they're almost hoping that they have a reason to publicly execute her. And Jesus turns away, he starts writing on the ground. We don't know why. Some people have speculated that he was writing the names of sins that the accusers were guilty of, you know, pride, hate, whatever. We don't know that. It's pure speculation. Maybe he was turning his eyes away because he didn't want to look at the ugliness of the scene. Maybe she was only half-dressed. She was dragged away in the act. We don't know, but he turns away. But the Pharisees keep pressing him. You know, Jesus claims to be God. He claims to be the fulfillment of the law. Well, the law was given to Moses, and the law says that she should be stoned. So what's he got to say about that? I think the problem, to some extent, with the story being very well known is that when we read it, we go in with certain assumptions. When I read the story, I immediately side with the woman and assume I have nothing in common with the Pharisees. I was reading the story just a little bit before Christmas, and we got a Christmas card from an old friend, an old school friend of my husband's, who is currently serving a long prison sentence for sexual crimes against children. And when I saw this card, I was incensed. I was, you know, why are you corresponding with him? We should have nothing to do with him. You know, he's beneath contempt. We should, you know, completely have nothing to do with this person. And I suddenly remembered the story and realized that there was more of the Pharisee in me than I care to admit. And I think, you know, I hope I'm not alone. Well, I hope I am alone, but I suspect I'm not alone, that we find it very easy to judge people. And the Pharisees of the time, they were the respectable people. They were the moral people. You know, they brought the sin, which presumably was being committed under the cover of darkness, considering the nature of the offense, they brought it to light. They were asking for the law to be upheld. But Jesus says no, he won't condemn her. Instead, he challenges her to go and leave her life of sin. So the Pharisees, who saw the law as light, saw it as a harsh light, as a maybe a search light or an interrogation light, rooting out evil, showing up sin, exposing it. But Jesus' concept of light is very different. It's a light that gives a new chance. It's almost like, you know, maybe a sunrise, a light that offers hope and a fresh start. The second story I want to look at is the story of the man born blind. If you've been reading John over the last few weeks, you'll notice that he has no problem at all with repetition. You know, we have the same themes coming up again and again. We have arguments that seem to go round in circles. And this story is kind of the epitome of repetition. But I really like it because it reminds me of how my brother tells a story. If he starts on a story, grab a chair, sit back, because he's going to revel in all the details. He likes the irony of the details. And I'm going to read the story kind of in that way because I think that's kind of how it's written. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." Just stop there for a second. So the theology of the day said, you know, if there was a disability or there was a disaster happened or, you know, some big catastrophe, it must be the result of sin. There were rabbis around at the time who said that children, babies could sin inside the womb. I have a hard time thinking what they could get up to, but that's what some of them said. But more people generally thought, well, it must be the result of the parents. And they would interpret literally verses like Exodus 20, verse 5, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So, you know, if you take that literally, it must be his parents, maybe even his grandparents that sin that make him be born blind. But Jesus, as so often happens when he's given two choices, goes with the third option. He says neither. It's nothing to do with that. Rather, it happens so the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, the works of God could be displayed in this man even if he wasn't healed. So I don't think we need to read this as saying that, you know, God made him be born blind so that later in life Jesus could come along and heal him. I don't think that's what this is trying to say at all. I think Jesus is saying, you missed the point. It's got nothing to do with sin. But as a result of him being born blind, you're now going to see the work of God displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. And here we see, we just go back to that just for a second. Here we see a theme that we've seen in a few places and runs throughout John, the idea of Jesus as an obedient son doing the works of the Father. But here we almost have a sense of urgency. You know, night's coming and we've got to work right now. It's almost as if Jesus can't help himself. He's got to act while there's an opportunity, even if it's the Sabbath. We don't know yet that it is the Sabbath, but it is. I read ahead, so. Okay, let's go on. After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word was sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that he was, others said, nah, he only looks like him. But he himself insisted, I am the man. How then were your eyes open, they asked. He replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see. Where is this man? They asked him. I don't know, he said. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was the Sabbath, told you. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed, and now I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a sinner perform such signs? So they were divided. So here we've got this this theological debate. I mean, Jesus made mud, that's work. He healed, that's work. And it's the Sabbath, so he's broken the law. He's clearly a sinner. Well, God doesn't listen to sinners, so he can't have healed the man. What's going on here? Then they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. The man replied, he is a prophet. They still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can see? We know he is our son, the parents answered. And we know he was born blind. But how he can see now or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He'll speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders, who had already decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That is why the parents said, he is of age, ask him.
So the parents, I mean, they told the truth. They said, yeah, he's our son, he was born blind, but, you know, anything more than that, we don't want to know, right? They were scared. They didn't want to get involved. I feel really sorry for the parents. You know, considering the theology of the day that, you know, if they had a son born blind, they must have done something. You wonder how much guilt they walked around with. You know, how many times they saw the neighbors gossiping about what it was that they'd got up to deserve this calamity. Or, you know, did they blame each other? Think that maybe the other had done something? Or have guilt themselves and think, oh, you know, we must have done something to offend God for this to happen. It must be very sad. It must be very hard for them. And then this amazing, wonderful thing happens. Their son is healed. and has barely had time to register, and they've been dragged before the leaders and threatened. It must have been very scary and confusing for them. Now, this reference to throwing them out of the synagogue may be one of those examples that we've seen elsewhere also, where the writer of John is reflecting to some extent the reality of his own day. By the end of the first century, there was a much clearer divide between Judaism and Christianity, and people were being thrown out or excommunicated from synagogues for believing in Jesus. It's very unlikely that there was any kind of formal excommunication for that during Jesus' own lifetime. Having said that, I'm sure that there were ways that the religious leaders could make people feel very unwelcome. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God by telling the truth," they said. "We know this man is a sinner." He replied, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." The man answered, "Now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. No one has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." To this they replied, "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us?" And they threw him out. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him.
I think this is a lovely part of the story where Jesus hears what happened to the man. And he goes and finds him to see how he's doing. You know, Chrysostom, one of the early church fathers, put it this way: "The Jews cast him out of the temple, but the Lord of the temple found him." Right there. And Jesus reveals who he is to this man. He tells him that he's the Son of Man, and the man believes. And we can see the kind of evolution in the man's thinking about Jesus in the way he describes him through the story. So at the beginning of the story, he is the man they call Jesus. It sounds like, you know, he's not really interacting with Jesus at all, doesn't know who he is. And then when he's challenged by the Pharisees, he says, you know, he's a prophet. So he's obviously kind of thinking a little bit more now. And then by the end, when Jesus reveals himself, he calls him Lord and he worships him. I think the writer of John is showing through this story how Jesus, the light of the world, brings light. Firstly, very literally, he heals man's physical blindness, but also spiritually, brings spiritual light to the man. And that light brings hope and it brings dignity. You know, this was a man who had been a beggar. He'd been completely dependent on other people for their charity. And possibly he'd also been dependent on them for his understanding of who Jesus was. But now he has this light, he has options, he can work, and he knows for himself who just Jesus is. So this light is more than just light. It's a life and it's hope and it's dignity for him. Meanwhile, the religious leaders, those who pride themselves on their spiritual sight and their moral spotlessness, they say it would be better to leave this man as a beggar in darkness than for anyone to sully themselves by working on the Sabbath. Quite a contrast there.
Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." So if we could just go back to the screen before. Thank you. Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world." If we were reading this verse just in isolation, we might think, okay, well, that means that Jesus came to earth to judge people. You know, he's the light of the world. That light exposes sin and judges. But we know that the writer of John doesn't think that. Even without the story of the woman caught in adultery, we read a few weeks ago, John 3:17. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. And that word condemn is the same as judge in the Greek, it's krino. And again in John 12, if anyone hears my words but does not keep them, I do not judge that person, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. So John's made it very clear, Jesus has not come to judge us. He has not come to judge the world. But it's almost as though he does allow us to judge him. And the Pharisees judge him, and they prove through that judgment that they are blind. Is Jesus trying to make the Pharisees blind? Clearly not. I mean, he sent them an irrefutable witness. He was a man that was born blind. Everybody testifies, yeah, he was born blind, and now he can see. Elsewhere, Jesus says, if you don't believe me for my words, believe me for my works. And here's his work, something that you really can't argue against. And the writer of John has made this story really clear, right? I mean, it's repeated over and over. It's hammered home. By the end of the story, you certainly know, okay, we know, it was mud. You went and you washed, and now you can see, we got it, right? But still, the Pharisees at the end of the story are saying, tell us the truth. What really happened? Makes me think of that saying, there is none so blind as those that will not see. So why does the writer of John put this story in here? I think he's challenging us to judge Jesus. I think he's saying, look, Jesus claims, this outrageous claim, to be the light of the world, to be the source of life and salvation. A light that brings forgiveness in the case of the woman, a light that brings healing and wholeness and dignity in the case of this man. And you've got the witnesses, they'll all testify that this is what's happened. Jesus did come and he did bring light, physical light as well as spiritual light. And then you've got the parents as a great example of people who don't want to know, don't want to get involved, we'll just keep our heads down, we don't want to judge. And then there are the Pharisees who've already judged and proved themselves to be blind. But I think the question is, who do we judge Jesus to be? Who do we think he is as the light of the world? I think all of us know what darkness is. I think we've all experienced darkness in different ways, whether that's guilt or fear or grief or doubt. We know what it is to experience darkness. And I think the writer of John is saying the wonderful news is that Jesus, the light of the world, is not going to condemn us for our darkness. He's not come to expose us and to judge us, but he's come to bring light that brings life, that brings hope, that brings forgiveness. So let's pray. Dear God, you know each one of us. You know where we experience darkness. You know that sometimes that darkness can even feel like it's overwhelming. We thank you, God, that you sent Jesus to be the light of the world, a light that came into our chaos and our confusion, into our grief, into our pain, into our guilt. I pray that each of us would experience your life-giving light, a light that brings hope and forgiveness and life. Amen.